He kept saying to me, be real, tell the truth. And I remember Lennon opened the door. And I felt that I really wasn't worthy of being on the same team as these greats.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Nicky Horn.
I was born actually not so far from here, in St John's Wood, in 1950. My parents at that time lived in Harrow. My dad had a ladies' hairdressing salon. We moved from Harrow to Palmer's Green. I went first to Franklin House Prep School, which was a really good prep school, small prep school in Palmer's Green. I then passed the common entrance exam, which I took at 13, to go to my parents wanted me to go to the City of London private school. Apparently I passed the interview, and then a couple of weeks later they wrote to my parents and said that they couldn't admit me to the City of London because they had filled their Jewish quota. I mean, you think about it now, it is just terrible. This is 1963. The City of London School had a Jewish quota, so they only let in a certain number of Jews. Appalling, really, when you think about it. I didn't come from a particularly Jewish home at all. You know, we did Friday nights because it was a good excuse to eat, you know, some really good food and for the family to be together. And I was forced to go to synagogue on sort of high days and holy days. But actually, that sort of Jewishness really got me into this sort of fairly ridiculous game, actually, that I'm still in. And because I was a member of a charity group, and you know, these groups would put on dances, there would be house parties where parents would give over their houses, or there would be dances at, you know, various clubs that would just be for members, and you'd sell tickets and stuff. I mean, I'd be perfectly honest, I wasn't being that altruistic. I just wanted to meet girls. And I remember there was one meeting that we had where they said they wanted to put on a dance. The DJ that they had couldn't do it. And, you know, did anyone want to be a DJ? I thought this would be a really good wheeze to sort of be on stage where I would be taller than most people. And I would see all these Jewish girls and I'd be like the centre of attention. And this would get me girls because, you know, being a short ass, you know, it wasn't easy. And I thought, this is great. And I was always into music. I had friends who would sort of introduce me and had introduced me to a lot of American soul music. I remember I heard Bessie Banks and the original version of Go Now. Goodbye. And so I became a DJ. A friend of mine, a guy called Glenn Roberts, his dad was a kosher butcher. Glenn and I built together this mobile discotheque called Sounds Unlimited. We were too young to drive, and I remember Glenn's dad used to drive us to gigs. He'd put the discotheque in the back of his car and he'd drive us to gigs. That's how I started. My parents used to love Sing Something Simple, which I loathed. But I remember Sunday evening, Sing Something Simple. Jack Jackson. I used to listen to Jack Jackson. It wasn't for the music that he played. It was just for the bits that he did, the things that Kenny Everett subsequently took. I mean, Jack was just brilliant, the things that he did.
You finished that paper yet?
No, I haven't.
Well, hurry up, I haven't seen it. I want to know what my stars say.
When were you born?
June the 21st.
What sign of the zodiac is that?
The crab.
It says, today you will meet a very romantic member of the opposite sex.
Well, good luck to him.
When I was 13, my dad bought home a Grundig TK-20 tape recorder, reel-to-reel tape recorder. And it was a present. And it was the best present I ever had. Because I took it up to my bedroom and I connected a radio to it. And I would record music off the radio. I'd listen to the Fab 208, to Radio Luxembourg. you know, this with this heterodyne signal coming in and out, which actually made it even more romantic. And I just thought, this is incredible. I can imagine these people sitting in the studio in the Grand Duchy playing music, and it was the most romantic thing that I'd ever heard. This is your friendly station, great to wait. It's the ring and the swinging station of the stars. I used to listen to Alan Freeman doing Pick of the Pops, and I used to record the program on my Grundig, and then I would edit out Alan's lyrics.
Greetings, pop pickers.
And I would then re-record my own lyrics and edit them in.
It's me again, Alan Freeman, and Sunday at 4 means Pick of the Pops.
And this is editing with a proper editing block, but, you know, to begin with, sellotape. And I made my own radio programs. That Grundig TK20 was just... it was my passport to this other world. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And then the pirates started. And I remember listening to Radio London. I preferred Radio London. I loved the jingles. Wonderful Big L.
Wonderful Big L.
I remember the day it closed. I remember the day that Radio London closed, and I was sitting in my bedroom. And I recorded it. I remember Duncan Johnson saying, Big L time is 3 o'clock and Radio London is now closing down.
Big L time is 3 o'clock and Radio London is now closing down.
And I just remember I cried. I sobbed.
Radio London.
That this radio station that I loved, that was part of my life, and it had closed, and I felt bereft. But I used to listen to Everett and Cash. I did listen to Peel occasionally as well. But, you know, all of these DJs, they all became friends. I mean, I even at one point went with a friend down to Frinton and, you know, stood on the cliffs with a torch shining it out to the guys on the boat. You know, I really, really wanted to be out there with them.
And that record is from a film, believe it or not. Be My Guest, that's the name of the film. It's also the name of the record, which is standing at 32 in this week's Fab 40, 32. That's,
And it was Everett. It was listening to Everett that really made me want to get into radio. I mean, to go from listening to him and then working with him at Capitol and, you know, being a mate was astonishing, really.
Yes, thank you. The Ivy League at number 37 from absolutely nowhere with Tossing and Turning. Have you ever seen Radio London's racing car?
My very first sniff of radio came in 1967. I met a record plugger at a coffee bar in Golders Green called the Golden Egg. And I'd been to a club. After the club, we'd all pile into the Golden Egg Saturday night, and I met this record plugger. He was a couple of years older than me, and I said that I really wanted to get into radio, and he was going on about, you know, how he'd go to the BBC, and, you know, he'd meet all the DJs and all of that, and I said, God, I'd love to do that, you know, how can I do that? He wrote on a napkin a map of how to get from the door of Broadcasting House up the stairs into the control room and then into the continuity suites. And one Sunday morning, I mean, think about this. I walk into the BBC. They didn't know me from Adam. There were a couple of commissionaires there, but there was no security or anything. You know, no one was wearing passes. They hadn't even been invented. And with this map in my hand, I sort of waved at the commissionaire, as if I kind of owned the place. I walked up the big staircase, looking at this map all the time, down the corridor, and then took the stairs down to the right. I can remember it now. I can see it. Into the control room. There were no locks on the doors or anything like that. past the TOM's office, the technical operations manager, and the office next to him was the Atom. So it was Tom and Atom, technical operations manager, assistant technical operations manager. Round to the right, right again, and there were the continuity suites where Radio 1 was broadcasting from. And I walked in. Tony Blackburn was, I don't think he was on the air, I think he was recording. And I just went, hello, I'm Nicky Horn. And he went, hello, I'm Tony Blackburn. I said, I'm a DJ, you know, can I watch? And he went, yeah, sure you can. And so I sat at the back and I watched him. And I stayed there all afternoon. And then Alan Freeman came in to do Pick of the Pops. Alan Freeman was a hero. Fluff walks in with his producer, Dennis Jones, and I'm sitting at the back of the continuity suite, in the studio, not the cubicle. And I said, you know, do you mind? Would you mind terribly if I watched you? And he went, not half, mate. And Dennis Jones was just such a sweet man. And they let me stay there. And other people came in, because Fluff always had people that would sit behind him and just watch. They weren't sort of groupies or anything, just sort of fans. And one of those people was Phil Swern. Phil, who became a very well-known producer, a musicologist. Phil was one of the guys that was there. And I used to go every Sunday. And we'd just sit there and we'd watch Fluff at work. I just felt that this was where I wanted to be. In this radio studio, watching this man.
And that's a pretty healthy end, Rat. This week, number 17, the Tremolos back in the Pick of the Pops top 20 there with My Little Lady. That's two newcomers. Here's the third one from Love Affair.
And it was like watching a ballet. There were carts flying all over the place, and the way that he kind of worked the desk was balletic. There was a choreography to it. I vowed that this is where I would one day sit. Someone told me that BFBS, British Forces Broadcasting Service, were looking for interviewers. And so I went to Dean Stanley Street, down the road from the House of Commons, and walked into British Forces Broadcasting Service and just said to the person on the desk, could I please come and talk to a producer? And Eggy Lay was a producer. And I went upstairs to see Eggy. Eggy said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be on the radio. And he said, well, here is a tape recorder. And he gave me a Ewer tape recorder. He said, here's a telephone number. Go to BBC Television Centre on Thursday. Ring this number and they'll let you in to Top of the Pops. Do an interview there with anyone that you can get. Go to the dressing rooms and do an interview. And if we put it on air, I'll pay you £7.76. That's a good deal.
Yes, it's number one. It's Top of the Pops.
I went away with the Ewer. And a couple of days later, I went to Television Centre. And I did an interview with Olivia Newton-John. She was my first ever interview. I knocked on the door of the dressing room and I said, hello, I'm Nicky Horn from British Forces Broadcasting Service. Can I talk to you? And she was very sweet and she said yes. If not for you. I can't remember the interview there, but it must have been really awful. Well, it couldn't have been that awful because they put it on BFBS and John Walters, there was a sharing agreement between BFBS and Radio 1. And whenever BFBS did an interview, Radio 1 had an option to take it. And John Walters, who was John Peel's producer, but was also producing a programme called Seen and Heard with Johnny Moran, which was a magazine show, and it featured interviews and sort of reviews and things like that.
A sort of rather a paradox there in thinking at the top. They're not quite sure, to me, whether they want it to be a pop station or whether they want it to be a popular station.
And John Walters picked up the interview. So my interview got played on radio, with Olivia Newton-John, got played on Radio 1. That became a kind of regular thing for me, that I would go to Top of the Pops every Thursday. Sometimes Radio 1 would commission me to go, and other times BFBS would do it. And that was really how I started at Radio 1. And then I met Roscoe, Emperor Roscoe, and that was really my big break at Radio 1. I was doing a program with a guy called Chris Grant. Now, Chris was a promo guy at Radio 1. He and I did this program together called the Horner Grant Phonographic Company. And we did it at a studio in Chalcot Road in St. John's Wood. I think it was called Sound Developments. And we did this program. And the conceit of this program was that because Chris had this very, very deep voice, and at the time I was a kind of Kenny Everett clone, and the conceit was that Chris and I were in a manor house. It was Jeeves and Worcester, really. And that people would come into the house and we'd interview them. Chris knew Lulu and Maurice Gibb. And we went round to their house in Kensington and recorded an interview with them as if we were at this country pile that we were in. And we recorded the links and stuff at Sound Developments. But we ran out of money. Chris was earning money, but I wasn't. And we ran out of money to put this program together because it was all recorded in bits. And the only way that we could do this was for Chris to take the tapes into Egdon House, where Radio 1 was then housed, late at night, and edit these tapes using BBC equipment. And he did this late on a Friday night. And Emperor Roscoe was walking around Radio 1 at that time and walked into CTS1, which was called the Cassette Transfer Suite 1 in Egdon House. And Chris was working in there editing us, and Roscoe heard my voice. And Roscoe said, "Is that Kenny Everett?" And Chris went, "No, it's this young bloke called Nicky Horn." And Roscoe said, "He sounds like Kenny Everett. Can he do a Kenny Everett voice for me?" Now, the reason behind this was that Roscoe followed Everett on a Saturday at Radio 1. And on the handover, Everett would always kill Roscoe. I mean, Everett was just so quick. Everett was always better prepared.
"I said go!"
"Oh, all right."
"Go wait for your duck to die!"
Beating us again. Can you imagine the two of them together, Kenny Everett and DLT in one studio? Wow, man. That's heavy. That's real heavy. Hello, everybody. Rock and roll time is here again. Emperor Roscoe, Midday Spin, Radio 1. Chomp, chomp, chomp!
So Mike Roscoe thought that if he had someone who sounded like Kenny Everett and records stuff, this would throw Everett off balance. So I remember I was at home, because I was living at home at the time. As I said, I had no money. And I was at my parents' home one Friday night, and the phone went, and it was Chris, and he said, "Roscoe wants to see you." So he gave me the address, which was a flat in Kensington, this amazing, huge flat. And I went there. Roscoe was there with his manager, a guy called Henry Henriod. And really, without much conversation at all, Roscoe said, "I need an assistant. Will you be my assistant and will you do warm-ups for me on my Roscoe Roadshow?" And there was a contract there, and I signed the contract. And within a few days, I'd moved out of Palmer's Green and moved in to Roscoe's flat. It had a studio in it, proper studio. And so I continued to teach myself to edit. And it was a real eye-opener for this, you know, little Jewish boy from from the sheltered background in North London to go to this rock and roll flat. And so I then used to go to Radio 1 with Roscoe every Saturday and sit while he did the show. I would edit jingles. I'd get Pam's jingles. We'd always get demo tapes of Pam's jingles, and I'd edit out whatever the radio station was and edit in R-O-S-K-O, Roscoe, and all that stuff. And I did tons of that.
And this is Radio 1, big news in London, big city.
Ah, the Emperor today has got one of the most beautiful engineers.
And I was his roadie on the Roscoe Roadshow, so we'd go all over the country in this double wheelbase Ford Transit van with a mattress in the back, which saw a great deal of use. And this was my life. For a couple of years, the Roscoe show on a Saturday, and then going off to gigs all over the place. I even went with him to Paris because he was still doing some shows occasionally for RTL in Paris, French Radio Luxembourg, because he lived in Paris for years, did Roscoe, and he showed me the delights of Paris. I can tell you I lost my naivety in those few years with Roscoe. It was just wonderful. And through him I met Aidan Day, who was his producer, and just had the most amazing time. I mean, I was so lucky, because it is, actually, it's about being in the right place at the right time. I mean, I was working for Roscoe, but I really wanted to do my own radio. And someone told me about United Biscuits Network, this radio station, in a biscuit factory in Austerlitz, on the site, actually, where Sky is now based, near the Gillette factory in Austerlitz. And they told me about this radio station that was a closed-circuit radio station that went to all of the United Biscuits factories in Harleston, Austerlitz, Manchester, Liverpool, and Tollcross in Glasgow.
Good evening. With me in the studio is a slippery floor. Tell me, do you find people are taking more note of our commercials and walking more carefully on you than before,
now that they've realised they're treading on dangerous ground, so to speak?
Well, let me put it another way. Do you think people are more aware of the
dangers? There were speakers all along the production lines. And this was a proper radio station, a proper radio station. And it was set up because they had such a huge turnover of people that it was thought that if they had their own radio station, something they could identify with and feel was part of their lives, then the staff turnover would reduce. And it did. And so I went and had an audition for UBN. And Neil Spence was the programme director, and Roger Scott was one of the DJs. Adrian Love was there too. Trish Williams, Paul Williams. Trish and Paul were the newsreaders. Pete Reeves was there. Pete was great. And Giles Squire. Giles Squire was there. So there was Peter Young came later. And Dale Winton actually replaced me. I auditioned, and Neil Spence gave me the job, and he put me on overnights. So I'd been there for a couple of months, and I kind of got my feet under the table a bit, and I was doing overnights. And overnights on UBN, you had to play quite a large number of Indian soundtrack music, because there was such a high percentage of Indian workers. They wanted to hear, you know, music that they identified with. And the only Indian music that we played were the soundtracks from various films. And they were rotated. So they had their own section in the library, and you just pulled one out, the first one, and played whatever track sort of fitted to time, and then put it at the back of the section so that each of these things would be rotated. And one night, it was a closed-circuit radio station, but Neil Spence had a line to his house. So Neil Spence could be in his house in Putney and he could listen to the output of his radio station. And I remember about 3 o'clock in the morning, one morning, it was scheduled for me to do one of these Indian tracks. And I thought, sod it, I'm just not going to do it. I can't be bothered. I think I wanted to play some Led Zeppelin. So I just put some Led Zeppelin on. And the phone went in the studio. Remember, this is like 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was Neil Spence on the phone. You horrible little man. You broken format. Be in my office at 9 o'clock. And he put the phone down. And I was shitting myself. I mean, I thought, this is the end of my career. I mean, he really gave me a terrible dressing down. I almost lost my job.
Anyway, that was Mike Lennox's climber this week. Mike Lennox, our breakfast boy, and he's going to be back on Tuesday. Meantime, the breakfast show is looked after and Cable Rouge Guys, of course, by Mr. What's his name? Oh, yes, Blackburn, the Blackburn man himself. Right? Right, we've got two...
The thing about UBN was that, and, you know, I tell the story about Neil Spence because it's funny, but it's true. It did impose a discipline. And UBN was a great training ground for all of us. Subsequently, when Roger Scott told me about Capital. He said, I'm going to audition for Capital. He said, you should too. I went, well, but Capital have said it. All the pre-publicity about Capital was that it was going to be a middle-of-the-road radio station. All the pre-publicity was that it would be like Andy Williams and all that sort of stuff. And I had absolutely no inclination to be on a radio station like that. I remember Roger said to me, you've got to audition. He said, I've auditioned. He said, I've met the guy who's the boss, and he said, it's going to be brilliant, you should audition. And he just nagged me so much that in the end I did it, and I sent this tape off. A couple of weeks later I heard, and they asked me to go in and audition. And I sat in this studio, and Dave Cash was the person who was the auditioner. I remember that, you know, this is Dave Cash. This is the man I listened to on, you know, Radio London, the wonderful Big L. And he's auditioning me. Oh, my God! I was so nervous. And I thought that I completely screwed the audition.
Mama never told me about that. Sister Sledge at 1252 from Capital 539.
And I didn't hear anything for weeks. Roger told me that he'd got a job. Didn't tell me which job, but he said he'd got a job. And I thought, well, that's it. I'm not going to get it, and I'll stay at the biscuit factory. And then one Saturday morning, I was at home. I just got married, and I was living in Hadley Wood. And my son had just been born. And I got the call, I think it was in July, 73. And it was Michael Bucht on the phone. And he said, hello, Nicky. Michael Bucht here from Capital Radio. And I'd like to offer you a job. Really? Yes, he said, come and see me on Monday morning. Have a great weekend. Bye. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Roger was thrilled, because Roger and I used to hang out. He'd come to my flat and I'd go to his, and, you know, our wives would see each other, and we both had young babies. And I went to see Michael. Michael offered me the show. He said, your show is called Your Mother Wouldn't Like It. It's a rock show. You can play what you want. And he said, but I don't want you to go any more left field than Mott the Hoople, which shows Michael didn't know much about rock music. He christened the show, and he offered me £50 a week. And that was it. Baby, if you just say you care. And I joined Capital on September the 3rd, 1973, on my 23rd birthday. Roger and I joined on the same day. And at that point, we weren't in Euston Tower. At that point, the office was in Piccadilly. Euston Tower was still being constructed. And Roger and I went in together on our first day at school to Piccadilly. And that was the start of my career at Capital. Isn't it good to know Capital Radio? Those early days of Capital were astonishing, because we would dry run the station before we went on the air. And I said previously that I sounded like a cheap version of Kenny Everett. And during these dry runs, Michael would tutor us individually as to how he wanted us to be on air. He kept saying to me, be real, tell the truth. Be real, tell the truth. Talk to one person. He made me get a photograph of someone that I cared for and put it by the microphone or in my eyeline. And he kept saying, talk to that person. And we would go through these dry runs, line by line by line, word by word. He described it as peeling the layers of the onion. Michael always used food metaphors, not surprisingly. Peeling the layers of the onion until you got to the core of the person, and then he built you back up again. And so that's when I became me on air, in those very early days of Capital.
But they want more than just something that plays records for them, because in the last resort, they can, you know, the radio station is not a jukebox. It's got to be about people.
And Michael encouraged us to think about how the radio station could benefit the community. It was terribly important to Michael that this radio station used its power to help the community and bring the community together. Michael Bucht had this phrase where he said that radio can act as a fulcrum for change. And he meant it. I mean, Michael was one of the most spiritual men I've ever met. He was a wonderful human being. I loved Michael Bucht, not just as a program controller. I mean, he could be horrible as a program controller, but he was a wonderful, wonderful human being. And it was Michael who encouraged us to think along these lines. So something like the flat share service was my idea in those early days before we went on air. And it survived for decades at Capital. The job finder, the helpline, all of those things were really sort of using the power of the swap shop. All of those ideas were using the power of the radio station to enrich the listener and make the listener feel as if we were part of their lives.
Good evening, this is Open Line on Capital.
Hello, Capital Open Line.
Capital Open
Line. 646 from Capital, and if you're searching London for a flat, a couple of people on the line now, on the flat share line. Remember, if you have a flat and you're looking for someone to share it with you, then the number to ring is 388-1255.
The feeling that we were groundbreaking, that we were part of something unique, was powerful, and it was palpable, and it was like a drug, really. The team that we had at Capital were people that really loved being with each other, and it's not just the team on air. You know, we still get together, those of us who were the sort of pioneers and who, you know, are still here. We get together fairly regularly and meet up. The presenters and the engineers and the people who were manning the phones, and there was the receptionist, Gray, and, you know, everybody. We were genuinely a team, and there was no delineation between the people who were on air and the people who were watering the plants. And this was to do with Michael Bucht, and to a degree, the great John Whitney, who was the managing director.
And by listening to the national services of the BBC today, you can very clearly, feel the influence of the local station impact.
But Michael fashioned that radio station, and I'd been there for about 3 months, and I'd been working with these people who were my idols, you know, Everett, Cash, Dave Simons, Tommy Vance, and I was doing this daily show. I had a crisis of confidence, and I felt that I really wasn't worthy of being on the same team as these greats. It was a crisis of confidence. And I remember going to Michael, and I told this story at his memorial because it shows what Michael was like in, I think, every sense. I felt like a very small fish in a very big pond. So I went to Michael and I said, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure that I'm doing well enough to be part of this team. And I don't know what to do. And he said, listen, short ass. He said, I didn't pick you because you're a good DJ, because you're not. I picked you because you're a nice bloke. Now fuck off and be a nice bloke on air. And as I walked out, he said, and remember, tell the truth and be real. And that was Michael. He just wanted me to be a nice bloke on air.
When you're weary, feeling small.
I think the early musical direction of Capital was, it could have been improved, to say the least. It was a bit incoherent, the music policy. After a while, they did some research and they found that very few people were listening. And the music policy changed overnight. It became less album tracks during the day and it became more kind of top 40. I was always allowed to play whatever I wanted. There was never any restriction on me at any time that I was at Capital. I had to fight for it when Richard Park came in, but I was never restricted in what I played in my first incarnation at Capital. But I think the music policy changed, and Roger Scott too was given free rein pretty much, although there was a rotation system that was built in, but it was very loose. I look back with enormous pride at what that radio station did. There was Peter James doing The Collection, a classical music program. There was me doing a rock show. There was Kerry Juby and Ina Clough doing a program of music from the war years, Under the Arches. There was a kids program, Hullabaloo, with Maggie Norden. There was a talks department. There was a daily serial, soap opera.
Honey, I dare.
Here we are then, Mr. Dare. From information received.
Oh, lovely words.
I mean, it's astonishing when you think that it was a full-service radio station, that the budgets that were needed to sustain something like that. I mean, it was astonishing, the breadth of what that radio station did, and all of the social things as well. I remember, one day I said to Michael, or to Aidan Day, I think it was at the time, I said to Aidan, it's just such a beautiful day. I want to go and do the programme from Hampstead Heath. Oh, all right, love, off you go. And I'd go with David Briggs, who eventually went on to write the format of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and became himself so rich that he bought an island in the Pacific. And I would go with David Briggs in the radio car, and we'd just sort of sit on Hampstead Heath and thousands of people would join us. You know, you could do that kind of stuff. You could just do anything you wanted. It was pioneering, this pioneering spirit that you can never capture again. I am so fortunate to have been born when I was born and to be part of commercial radio at that point. Because I was having this conversation with someone the other day. I'm not going to drop any names, but a rock star. And we were talking about how we were lucky to be born. He's a couple of years older than me, to be born at the time that we were. Because his rock band would never have been as incredibly successful as they were if he'd have been born a few years later. And I would never have had the career that I had if I had been born a few years later. And I'm always incredibly grateful to have had that opportunity. One of the things that I am very proud of was something that we did at Capital, and I'd like to sort of acknowledge Tim Blackmore. Tim was the programme director of Capital for a good while, and Tim and I met at Radio 1 when he was doing The Story of Pop, and he was doing Noel Edmonds. And we talked about Your Mother Wouldn't Like It, but one of the programmes that I did that was very successful was a programme called Six of the Best, which was on Saturday nights from 9 till midnight. Tim Blackmore said to me, I've got this title for a programme called Six of the Best, and I don't know what to do with it, but I think it's a great idea for a title. You know, what do you think we can do with it? And we agreed that we would split the programme, as it was Six of the Best and it was 3 hours, we would split the programme into half-hour segments, and we would get the audience to vote on the music that would be played in the next half hour. So the first half hour of the programme, I would play music, and then I would say while I was playing that music, and if you want to choose the music for the next half hour, ring us now. And it sort of evolved into a satirical programme where the choices would be, choose music that Maggie Thatcher might play to Ted Heath. We would choose the category and then they would choose the music that went in it. And the programme was incredibly successful. So it pushed people from half hour to half hour. So the programme, I think after its second or third Rajar figures, I think it went up by like 200%. I had no idea what music was going to come the next half hour. So we had people in the record library who were pulling music, rushing it round to the studio, albums, and I'd put them on and then play them. Tim Blackmore had a very big hand in doing, and in fact we did the programme as well on Radio 1. We called it Barbed Wireless, because we couldn't use the name Six of the Best. We called it Barbed Wireless, and we did it from Phil Swern's bedroom, because Phil had this incredible library. in his bedroom, in his house that he lived in Wembley. And we did it for Radio 1 as well. But that sort of free-form, fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants radio was something that no one did. And, you know, you could never, ever do that now.
Yes, once more, Cuddly Ken and Roger Scott with the Hot 100 Show, your very own London faves, brought to you this week by Kamikaze Motorcycles.
The only motorcycle in the world that has no brakes.
The video of Kenny Everett that comes into my head is him just being around the playpen. We had this open plan office that we called the playpen. And he would come in, and he was, in real life, exactly as he was really on air. That he'd come in and all hell would break loose. Hello, darlings. Hello, loves. And he'd sort of stand on the desks and sort of, you know, just dance or, you know, just chat to everybody. And then he'd go and sort of bury his head into a studio and start editing things. He was a very shy man. And we lived very close to each other at one time in Notting Hill Gate, where he lived with Lee, his wife. And I was between wives at the time. And I was living on my own in Notting Hill. We would spend time together and go to a Russian restaurant in Ifield Road that had booths with curtains, because he didn't really want to be seen by people and go up to him. But, you know, he was that shy that he really didn't like being recognised in the street or in a restaurant. But he was an amazing, delicate... He was like a butterfly. He was very, very delicate, but a wonderful soul. He had a wonderful soul, did Ev.
That's my generation's version of Vera Lynn. Definitely. The Beatles, and off the Help album, that was the night before.
Kenny came to me one day, and he said, Nicky, darling, do you fancy going to New York to interview John Lennon? And I said, well, of course, Ken, but, you know, why not you? And he said, well, he said, Lennon's been in touch. And silly sausage, he wants to talk about some heavy things. He said, it's not really my sort of bag, so I suggested you. Do you want to go? So I said, of course, Kenny, I'd love to. I've got, you know, shitting myself that I'd be going off to New York. And I went to the hotel, and I was told to go to the Dakota Building the next day. And I got in the cab, and I remember it was a very hot day. And I got out of the cab by the Dakota, and I was a bit early because I really didn't want to be late. The Dakota Building is a very impressive building, but it's also quite imposing. The architecture of it is quite kind of gothic. So it's a very imposing building, and that sort of combined with my nervousness, you know, really got to me. So by the time I got to the door to ring his buzzer, I my hands were shaking so much that I could hardly sort of hit the door knocker. And I remember Lennon opened the door as I was, my hand was up to sort of push the knocker again, and he saw my hand up and he went, how? And he put his hand up, went, how? And touched my hand, and he said, come in. And he said to me, I've just made some cookies. He said, they're not, you know, an instant bake. He said, I've made these myself. And he made them for me. He made me chocolate cookies. He said, they're just coming out of the oven. So he said, would you like some cookies and coffee? And at the smell of these cookies, I can still smell these cookies, just the most amazing aroma. And Yoko wasn't there. They just got back together. It was after his kind of long weekend. And we took the coffee and the cookies into the living room. And I remember a white shag pile carpet, a white piano. The only thing of colour in the room was a brass telescope that looked out onto the Hudson. Most amazing view. He saw how nervous I was. I mean, I could hardly hold the coffee. My hands were shaking so much. It was horrible. And he realised how nervous I was. And instead of the normal thing of an interviewer warming up the interviewee, he warmed me up for an hour or so. We just chatted about anything. And when he realised that I was not nervous anymore and that I'd really relaxed and settled down to be in his company, he said, right, you know, you can switch the tape recorder on now. And he gave me the most incredible interview, where he talked about being followed by the FBI, having his phones tapped. I mean, it was, you know, really heavy stuff, as Everett had suggested. And of course, when the interview went out, everyone poo-pooed, you know, Lennon, oh, he's being a nutcase. You know, he's paranoid. But actually, years later, when the FBI released the records for that year, it showed that he had been followed. His phones had been tapped. He was a person of interest. And they did want him out of the country. So all of those things that Lennon had said. But it was that kindness that he showed me. You know, he didn't have to show me that. He still would have said what he wanted to say. But he wanted me to be relaxed. This is John Lennon wanting me relaxed. And that kindness and sensitivity was astonishing. I've been there for 13 years. I have been very successful. The program had done incredibly well. But I felt that it was time for me to do something else. Capital had kind of evolved into, they did that experiment where there was this CFM at the weekends, which was me and Roger and Richard Skinner, I think, on CFM, which was the FM bit, and AM was doing a different program. It was the first sort of experiment, really, in splitting the frequencies.
And good morning, it is 10 o'clock, it is Capital CFM 95.8 for the very first time. I'm Roger Scott, and as you can hear behind me, our studio is not quite complete. Let's see what everybody's doing. Let me introduce you to the crowd who are going to be with you for the next couple of hours. Paul Burnett is over here. Paul, what are you doing?
In the end, they decided that they would put gold on AM and that FM would become a much younger station. This was when Richard Park came in. And I think that we both felt, Richard and I, felt that it was time for me to move on. There was no sort of animosity or anything like that. It wasn't like I'm being fired. In fact, I remember Richard saying, oh, Nicky, you're still on the bench. Well, I've been on the bench ever since. And at the time, I was doing the NFL on Channel 4, and the NFL program was, Touchwood, doing extremely well. And I had my TV career, and I was doing a, subsequent to that, I did a music program on Channel 4. So I thought it was time really for me to leave radio for a while. And then I came back to radio. I was offered a job by Mark Story, because I'd known Mark from Radio 1 days and from Capital, because Mark was at Capital for a while. And Mark then went to become managing director, I think, of Virgin. Anyway, he said, would I like to do the Drive Time show? Nick Abbott was doing it at the time, and it wasn't right for Nick. Nick is a brilliant, brilliant talk jock. A Drive Time show didn't really suit him. And they asked me if I would do it. And so I did. I was there for, I don't know, 4 years, I think. Virgin, much more music, 12:15. When I was at Radio 1, I was doing interviews, and I only had my own program for 4 weeks when I did that tryout program on Saturday afternoons that Roger Scott did. But he didn't do it under his name, Roger Scott. He did it under the name Bob. Oh God, what was the name?
Bob Baker.
I'll tell you what I think we'll do this weekend, seeing as how it's the third round of the FA Cup, big football weekend.
I did some documentaries for Radio 1. One program, a documentary called Sussa Studio. Oh my God, why did I call it that? I feel so embarrassed now. Sussa Studio. It was about Trident Studios and the history of Trident, which has a very rich history, and we did 6 shows in that. One of the shows that I really loved doing on Radio 2 whenever I stood in, which I did for a good few years just as a kind of swing jock, was Overnights at Pebble Mill, where the BBC, and this could only happen with the BBC, where they would pay for me to travel either first-class train, or they would pay for my petrol to go up and spend the weekend in Pebble Mill at a hotel, a five-star hotel in Birmingham, where I would spend the weekend. And I would then go to Pebble Mill Studios and broadcast from, I don't know, midnight till four or two till six or something, when I could have easily just literally walked from my home to Broadcasting House and done it from Con C in Broadcasting House. But no, for some reason, the overnights had to come from Pebble Mill. Regionality, it was called. I mean, bonkers. But being in Pebble Mill, which was a bit like being in a Victorian mental hospital, but with no patients, late at night, in the middle of the night, at the end of a corridor, in this studio on your own, where you were self-opping, you would go into network on your own. The only talkback that you had was to the control room in London. So you'd be completely on your own. I'd turn the lights out. I'd just have one angle poise light. It was a bit like, you know, the album cover for Donald Fagen, The Nightfly. Well, it was a bit like that. Broadcasting through the night when there is no one around it was just a magical time for me. Because it is about the power of radio at that time. You can talk to one person and you can have a real conversation with them and you can make a real connection with them at that time. You can feel that connection. Radio 2. I particularly enjoyed my spell at Classic FM because I was back with Michael Bucht. Michael asked me to join Classic FM when it first started. And I said, no, I'm not really interested. I mean, I had a passing interest in classical music. It wasn't as if I was completely ignorant about it, but I didn't feel that was right. And about a year into Classic FM, Michael and I went out for a meal, and he asked me again if I would join. And he said he had this program called Masterclass. It was a sort of multifaceted program. So the idea was that the program would teach young people the national music curriculum, and it would also have pamphlets that would be published in conjunction with the series. So, you know, a multifaceted program. And he said, I'd like you to present it because I think you do a really good job at it. You know, you have done this trick which we'd done on Channel 4, which was that I didn't know anything about American football, which is why I was hired. And that if there was something I didn't understand about American football, then I would ask the expert next to me, and Miles Aitken, who was the expert then, would tell me about it, and therefore I would then communicate that to the viewer. And that worked incredibly well for Channel 4 and for me, obviously. And so Michael thought that we could replicate that in Masterclass. And he said, and I'd like you to do some executive work on it as well. And I would like you to become the executive in charge of broadcasting for Masterclass. And so he said, you know, you can put all your social skills to bear in making this series multifaceted. And I loved doing it. It was an absolute highlight to be back with Michael on this pioneering radio station, which Classic FM was. I mean, basically, Classic FM was Capital playing classical music. That's what it was. It wasn't anything new that Michael did. He just imported those ideas, expanded them somewhat, and made it into this incredible radio station. I have been very, very fortunate over the years to have interviewed sort of many, many rock stars. And to have grown up with many of them as well. You know, the people that I met at Top of the Pops in those early days, or I met at Radio 1 when they were starting their careers, or the Roscoe Show. You know, Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin, doing a Peel session at the Paris Studios. You know, I've known Jimmy since those days. Nick Mason and David Gilmour of Pink Floyd. I mean, we've all kind of grown up together. So I have been very, very fortunate. I think I'm proud to have been part of that team at Capital, the pioneering team at Capital, to have done the things that we did together that changed radio, I think, for many years.
Listening to the Pink Floyd through stereo headphones always does something to my head. If you can get near a stereo tuner and put your headphones...
It's sad to me now that a lot of those rules are no longer respected and that radio is a completely different animal now to what it was. I don't want to sound kind of bitter and twisted, you know, well, it's not like it was in my day. It's not like that at all. Things change, things evolve. Sometimes they evolve for the better and sometimes they don't. I'm not saying that what we did was any better than what radio is now. All I'm saying is that what we did in those days was different. That's what I'm saying. I think I'd like to be remembered as someone who was real and who told the truth.